Folks, welcome back to Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul, in no particular order.
We're equal partners here. We both feel weird about our names coming first, but, so I keep saying Paul and Sarah. Name,
but you were the female lead, and you were number three on the call sheet, so I think it's more important.
I was not number three on the call sheet. I was way down the call sheet.
I was number 11, which I always said was two number ones.
This one goes to 11.
This is not something we should spend our energy on.
No. Okay. Yeah, nobody has a lot of energy these days. The world is nuts. But today we have our first guest, which I'm actually very, very excited about. His name is Brad Turner, and he directed the episode that Paul and I have quite literally just watched. And it is it's a brutal episode. It starts with toes getting cut off. It has a crushing scene between Dominic and Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul does some dastardly deeds in the woods.
Yeah, our first gun death, and my first Kellerman body count, which
really does rack up.
It racks up real quick.
Very quickly.
Also, want to give a shout out to John Nunziato, who designed our logo. What he did for us is incredible. The logo is so cool, and it's going to make for great merch and great prizes for our contest. And he put up with a little bit of actor neuroses while making our logo, and it was kind of better than we dreamed it could be. So thank you, John. Let's give you a little snapshot of what was going on in the world and put this show in context in
Calistine
that world.
Index.
This is the Calistine Index. This week's Calistine Index. The episode was called Cell Test. It premiered at 9 p.m. on September 5th, 2005. It was written by Paul Shearing and Michael Pavone, although it only said Michael Pavone on screen. Directed, as we mentioned, by our first guest, the one and only Brad Turner.
Okay, so blurb on the episode. Two steps forward, one step back, which is also a Paula Abdul song. You get bonus points if you were thinking about that too.
No, because that song was not was actually forward, called that song was actually called
Opposites Attract. Fine, but it was also her and an animated cat, right? If I remember correctly,
DJ Scat Cat
in the DJ Scat Cat, who was undoubtedly not a prison
person. And I believe Arsenio Hall was also in that video, but I may be conflating things.
Damn.
All right. Go on.
Okay, so two steps forward, one step back. Michael gets Abruzzi on his side. John Abruzzi, and proves Sucre's trustworthiness, but then loses a valuable piece of his plan, which is Sucre, and we meet Haywire for the first time, which is amazing.
The show was up against college football again on ABC. This was Florida State versus Miami. Florida State won in a squeaker 10-7. A rerun of Two and a Half Men on CBS, and on NBC, a rerun of Las Vegas. The lead-in, meaning the show that was on in the slot before us on Fox, was Nanny 911, which was sort of appropriate. Or not. I don't really. Maybe not. But I don't know. There weren't any nannies.
Also happening on September 5th, 2005, U.S. President George W. Bush nominated Judge John Roberts to the Supreme Court. He would later win the nomination and become Chief Justice. Also, Apple announced, or this is 2 days later on September 7th, Apple announced the iPad Nano. Those little
little bitty ones.
Like what, like 1,000 songs or something?
Something. I mean, they were incredible.
I think I got one as a wrap gift, possibly.
I got one on a wrap gift from private practice. It was the it was the camera one. It was the one that you could shoot video on. It was insane.
Oh, I just have that. It.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've still got my little thing. That's the point.
Also on this day, Jerry Rice, Hall of Fame wide receiver for the San Francisco 49ers, and I believe the Oakland Raiders at one point, announced his retirement, and Paul McCartney released Chaos and Creation in the Backyard, which won widespread critical acclaim and was nominated for several Grammys.
Okay, and I have two pieces of, I suppose, memorabilia is a strong word for it, but I found these two things when I was going through. I have this giant milk crate of stuff from season one. It's mostly scripts, but I have it. I'm showing this to Paul right now so he can see it.
This is the TV guide.
You can hear me flipping the pages. I'll put pictures of this on our Instagram stuff so you can see it. It is the TV guide from this week, September 4th to 10th, 2005. It has who on the cover, Paul?
Tom Brady.
It also covers The OC, The Biggest Loser, Night Stalker, Emmy's Countdown. There's a sense of what was going on there. And this is amazing. Check this out, Paul.
Oh, wow. Don't miss the best new drama on TV, Prison Break. That is a full page ad in black and white.
Yep. And that was a quote from the, what, Toronto something, right?
Toronto Star. And it's Lincoln, Michael, Veronica, and Dr. Sarah Tancredi.
I can't believe I actually made the
It's pretty thingy. Cool.
Piece number two. This is Inside TV Magazine, which I got to be perfectly honest, I didn't realize was a thing.
Nope.
On the cover is Eva Longoria, Lindsay Lohan, Jessica Simpson. So, okay, so they're all on the cover along with Grey's Anatomy. And so this is part of what was going on then. But this is crazy to me. The show had been on the air 1 week. And look at this. There's a two-page article about it. Inside TV goes behind the scenes of one of the year's most buzzed about new shows. There's some photos of the show and us. Again, I'll put all this stuff up on our Prison Break podcast Instagram. Quick blurb. It says, think Shawshank Redemption meets 24 with equal parts, heart, thrills, and family drama, not to mention two hot and oh-so-talented stars. They mean Paul and me. No wonder the show is getting tons of hype. We're all feeling a bit under pressure, admits Dominic, 35. But executive producer Dom Peruse tells Inside TV she's confident the suspense will keep viewers coming back. It's a life and death situation that appeals to people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what's surprising to me is the pace of the publicity machine and all of that. Like, all that had aired was the double billing of the pilot and episode one. Mm. And the very next week in print, they're hyping the show as one of the season's quote unquote breakout hits. That's just a strange pace to me, because now you have to air like two seasons before anybody bothers reviewing a show. And listen, for all I know, both of those publications are owned by Rupert Murdoch, who also used to own Fox. Anyway, I will put pictures of these fine publications up on our social media. If you want to check out our photos, our Instagram is at Prison Break Podcast.
Now, please listen to the rewatch. If you want, we'd love for you to watch the whole thing with us, which is in our bonus material.
This is dirty. So dirty.
You're saying like infection dirty?
No, like something's rotten in Denmark dirty.
Oh, I see, food, I see.
And he stepped on gardening shears.
Have you ever not gotten a random call from a prison? Because I've gotten multiple. Multiple.
Please I'm tell me that's member. A joke.
No, it's not a joke.
What?
It's not a joke.
You get multiple calls from prison?
I have, yes. I don't think they're specifically for me. I think they're literally random reach outs. I believe I'm about to kill my first person ever as an actor.
Are you?
And with that, we'll be right back.
All right. Welcome back, everyone.
Now, we're going to discuss the episode that we just watched, but it's not just going to be Sarah and I babbling on incoherently about little details nobody cares about. But we will have somebody who really can speak to the whole thing, who is Brad Turner. He directed this episode. He had directed this episode. He directed one of the final episodes of season four, The Old Ball and Chain. And he directed part one of The Final Break. So he is very much part of the Prison Break family. Brad also won an Emmy for his work directing 24. And he also won a Peabody Award for a limited series called Human Cargo. He's directed just on Homeland, amazing. Hawaii Five-0, Psych, Stargate. Over 200 episodes of television, which is extraordinary. It is our honor to welcome Brad Turner.
Well, my name is Brad Turner, and I directed episode 3 of Prison Break. I directed, ironically, the second episode when it went to series, and the second last episode.
Oh,
yep.
Finished.
That's right.
The studio asked me to come to Chicago and direct the first episode after the pilot, but it was episode 3. Yeah. It wasn't episode two, it was episode three, but I think we shot three first.
Oh.
Something like that.
Three before Mike Watkins' episode.
That makes sense now. In retrospect,
actually kind of does.
I think that's what we did. If not, yeah, I'm positive that's what it was, because Robbie Greenberg was the DP. And
Robbie Greenberg was a DP?
Yep. And I'd never worked with Robbie before. And we were really setting the tone after the pilot.
Yeah.
And we arrived, and the most interesting setup, and I don't know how it went on from there, but they literally had an office in sort of downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. They had a studio in like a studio complex.
On the west side.
Where the prison cells were being built. Mm-hmm. And then they had
Joliet
way out in Chicagoland somewhere.
Yep.
And the first thing, because I was a producer director at that point, the first thing I said is, you know, you got to put one of these three things together.
Yeah.
Because this is going to be very difficult to navigate. It's so interesting. We never shot in the stage because the stage wasn't ready.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we shot that episode all with all practical cells and all.
So that giant shot going up like three rows of cells.
It was real.
That was real.
Because I remember, Sarah, they never built until season three, I think. They didn't build a prison that was that elaborate, frankly, that had levels like that. So that's why I thought, oh, this must be actually Joliet.
Wow.
Yep, it was. We went to the office, prepped the show, and then basically literally never saw the office
again. Never saw the office again, sure.
Because then we were off. Robbie and I were off shooting in, I think we shot a couple of scenes in downtown Chicago.
With me.
Beautifully.
Yeah.
With me.
But also
and with,
the scene.
Yep.
Yeah, with, the Robin and Sebastian, the Veronica Sebastian breakup scene was gorgeous.
Yes.
On the river
Robin
with
Tunney.
Bridges.
We shot somewhere in, not as easy to find in Chicago as you think, somewhere in a kind of forest preserve area, which was pretty far out on the west side when I kill
Letitia Barrett.
Letitia, played by Adina. Yeah. And that was I remember that being almost a full day. No, it couldn't have been.
Yeah.
It had to be a half day, right? Because
you're
definitely fighting the light, but it was a move for sure.
Yes, it was.
Half thing. And just so, Art, just for our listeners, one of the things that Brad did that's incredible is, as we talked about in our first episode, when you shoot a pilot, especially in those days, and they bring somebody like Brad Ratner in, mm-hmm. we had 20 days, 25 days to shoot.
Yeah.
We had $20 million. We had this huge feature DP. It was like shooting a feature. And then they say, oh, the show's picked up. Here's episode two.
Compressive.
You have 8 days. Mm-hmm. You have a third of the money. And it needs to look and feel as good as the pilot did. So it is always an incredible, I think there's more pressure on that episode than even on shooting a pilot, in my experience. It's always like, how is this show going to work? Are we going to be able to pull this off? Mm-hmm. And it always falls usually on the director's shoulders to figure out if it can be done or not. And you certainly did it. We kept saying while we were watching, look at that beautiful shot.
It's beautiful.
Look at that great scene. Look at this cool coverage. So you clearly got it done. Do you remember how much prep you did, how much time we had to shoot? Do you remember any of those things?
Yeah, the one thing that I think that helped me a lot was our showrunner, Joel Surnow, on 24, was working on the pilot with one of our editors. And before I left for Chicago, he called me in and asked me to take a look and at what he was, what some of his ideas were about possibly helping the show make it a little more interesting. And we sat and looked at the cut and sort of talked about what we thought could strengthen and what could be better, what could be work more better visually and things like that. And I think that in a lot of ways I feel like I brought a little bit of the sensibility and the pacing from 24 to Prison Break. Mm-hmm. A totally different show, but I think the reason that Joel was looking at it was just to try to bring some of that energy to the show. Mm-hmm. And so that helped a lot, because when I got to Chicago, I had that in mind. And you know, it's really interesting when you do a pilot. I mean, it's literally, I always say it's got some explaining to do.
Yeah.
Literally, it's 1 hour of explaining what we're tending mm-hmm. to do for the, you know, the number of episodes you're doing after it.
What's the world? What's the pace? Who are the people? What's the problem?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But you know, the opportunity you have in front of you is you can second guess everything the pilot director did. So you actually, you have the advantage of seeing it on its feet. Mm-hmm. You know, and you get a pilot script. It's just, it feels like a lot of pipe laying and a lot of explanation and all that stuff. And you're trying to make that interesting, but literally once that's set in the audience's mind, then you can play. Then you're like, you're off.
Yeah.
You just find out what character is more interesting. The writers immediately go in that direction. They immediately say what the strengths were. So in my opinion, there's never been a bad pilot shot. What it is it's what we do to support the vision of that pilot that makes it work. It's like it's the next director. Like you said, the next director is really important because they have to take the strengths of what was happening in the pilot. And that goes to the writing too. The writers take the strength of the pilot, what happened in the pilot, and they move on with that and just make, and that's exactly what Paul did with the show. I mean, we're sitting in the lobby of the Drake Hotel. I met Paul for the first time and he's going, you know, this was a feature.
Yeah.
And Dana decided to make it a TV series. And he says, I don't know how to make it a TV series. We're writing it. I have a writer's room and we're making it. But he said, this was a feature. And I said, but Paul, that's what's great about it. If it was a feature, that's what's great about it. Because that's, you know, back then, that's what television was trying to do, was be a
right.
feature.
That's right.
You know, and it's now features are trying to be television. It's an odd thing that's happening. But
yeah.
But the most important thing I said to Paul is, listen, we can do this. It can happen. He said, well, you know, at the end of 10 episodes, the guys are going to get out. And I said, oh, okay. And I remember like 2 months later, he said, you know what? They're out in episode 4. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I thought that was one of the best stories. It's like, Now the network wants them out. They don't want to spend the whole season with them behind bars. One thing I can really speak to is they cast exactly the right people to do this show. I mean, yep. It was one of the things about the entire cast, everyone that was involved in this show. I was always so shocked and amazed at how good everybody was. After seeing the pilot a couple of times, especially with Joel, I knew the actors were great. And so one of the things that always works for me is bringing respect into any situation. So mm-hmm. the first thing I said to Dominic is, you and Wentworth are amazing. Like this show is going to do very well. And what we have to do is we just have to really find a way to keep the tension high, because that's what's working. The tension between you two, the tension when I went to the prison, I said, make no mistake of it, one of the biggest characters in this thing is this prison.
Yes.
This prison is a huge character, and don't ever think that it's not playing into what's happening, because you guys, we all go home to the hotels or your apartments or whatever every night. You guys are living here. This is where you live. You have to keep relating to this as your home. Mm. And remember that you can't do anything here in this prison without somebody watching. You can't gesture to somebody where they don't analyze that gesture as being something. So just be aware of it, you know, in your body type. And then from that point on, as a director, you get, I wouldn't call it respect, but you get, you know, this person's paying attention mm-hmm. to what is working. And then we're going to try to go to that level. We're going to try to be the best that we can be, because he's already identified, he or she's already identified that I know what I'm doing. That's already there. It's a matter of being able to make them look and be as good as they can be. That's what I'm there for. I don't care what people think of me, but what's important is this character is what everyone's watching to move the story along and to feel what they're feeling. But that was easy on that show.
The way we think about theater and film, and I would say pilots work this way too, is that you have a director and you have a writer and you have actors, and they're crafting this thing together a lot of times. But in television, because directors become guests a lot of times, they come in when something is established, or they come in after a pilot, even when something's established, and the actors have been living with a certain character and with the dynamics for sometimes years. And then a director will come in, and it's a complicated thing to come into a dynamic you don't know, as Brad was saying, about just dealing with personalities. But then even creatively, you know, if there's a big character turn in an episode, let's say, and the director's responsible for telling that story, and the actor's like struggling with it or doesn't like it or what have you, it can be tricky because the actor has been kind of the guardian, if you will, of this character for so long that they're kind of the expert on it. And that can just be, I don't know, it can be a point of tension. I just know.
The way I handle those situations is pretty clear. You, I think you have to, when you come in as a visiting director, when you do anything, you have to come in with the knowledge that the actors are thinking what you're thinking. What Paul's thinking. And that is that, oh, here's a new person coming in, going to, you know, change things around. So the first thing you have to do to build a relationship is acknowledge how good the thing is up till now, which is what I was talking about earlier. Mm. And that if anything, I'm here to make my story work. And if the story does include a big character swing like that, what I do in pre-production is talk to the showrunner and say, listen, is this person aware that they're going to do this big character swing? And if you talk to that person about it, because it's a concern for me, because I'm sure that actor has a much better handle on the character than I do. And I need you two guys to connect and make sure that you have talked this through. And if I could be included on that, I'd really appreciate that. Yeah. And that's how I would handle that situation. And I have in the past identified things like that, because I do believe that all the actors are custodians of their own character. And the character, listen, we've proven this through the history of television and film. There's been millions of characters written. For each of those characters, there's a million possibilities of people to play those characters. Mm-hmm. There's a million different ways that character would have been played if another person had played that role. We hear these stories all the time. So that if you go backwards in time, you go, okay, I get it. This character now is going to be this person. Mm-hmm. It's not a character. That person has to move my story along and not know things in advance. Mm-hmm. You know, not get ahead of themselves in terms of what they know and what they don't know, even though they've read the script. But the way that person's playing the role, the emotions they bring to that role is going to be their own. And I'm not the custodian of that. They are. And that's what's important when you're going to come into these situations, is you understand that you feel very strongly about something. Yeah, you feel very strongly. The way you do that, the way you make that work, is going to be up to you, not me. I do know that I need to feel like you feel strongly about it, but I don't need to tell you how to do that. Mm-hmm. Because guess what? You may have,
that's
one
your
person
job.
May have a whole different way of doing it. Mm-hmm. And you know what? As long as I feel it, then that works. And that's the most important thing. And where you will, you know, I've often said that, but it's like a pendulum. You go in, everybody gives you the benefit of the doubt. This is negative, this is positive. As soon as you start saying things that get into character, you go into the negative area. But as soon as you get something good, it'll swing back to the middle again. You have to play that. You have to be well aware of that. If you put your foot in your mouth, you've got to work to get it back.
Yep.
And that's the way it works. It's like you never know.
Yep.
You always run into people who are going to be opposed to you right from the beginning, and then you just have to work. So maybe you're here with some of the actors, you got to pull yourself back to here, and you find a way. You just have to find a way to do that. And luckily on Prison Break, I never had to do that because I always felt, and maybe it was because it was very early in the go, you know, that we were only at episode three and probably just starting the series. There was a lot, it felt like a movie. It felt like we were, you know, really still working on who everybody was. Mm-hmm. But that was not my job. My job was to make the show, give the show some pace, give it some visual style, and really support how good these actors were and how great these characters were coming across on the screen.
Well, and you're shooting a 54-page episode. So, I mean, when you got into the edit, and P.S., just for, you know, the geeks out there like us, you're shooting it on film.
Yep.
So every take costs something,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to, you know, our sort of eternal cards these days where you can sort of keep going. But when you got into the edit, I mean, I imagine a show like this, Paul's writing's pretty tight. And there's a lot of, you need to know this in order to move on to this. This is a critical piece of information. But you're also shooting for a network. So you've got exactly 44 minutes and not a second longer, more or less. You have a 54-page script. Do you remember what that edit was like? I mean, did it come in, you know, 8 minutes long and you got to figure out how to...
You know, I shoot every scene like it was going to be in the movie. And I shoot every scene like it was its own movie. And I make it really difficult for the showrunner to take anything out. and it's like it's like
good
I've so many times I've had people say to me, I just love it the way it is, but it's, you know, 8 minutes long. I think we can find it, but it's going to hurt. And it's gonna,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Or they'll say it'll be 8 minutes long, and then we'll get it down to 3 minutes long, and they'll go, this 3 minutes is going to hurt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And nine times ten out of ten. What's really comes to issue with me is it's usually stuff that identifies a movie from a TV episode.
Right.
It's like that long moment yep. where you ask somebody a question and they're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
In TV, they'll answer you right away.
All that air goes out. All the air.
Exactly. Exactly.
But I will say this: one of our favorite scenes rewatching that episode was a scene where LJ, who's Lincoln's son, is mandated by his probation officer or whatever it is, he's gotten into trouble, to go to prison and spend time with his father. And there's this beautiful scene that really doesn't advance plot per se, other than Lincoln has decided he's going to want LJ to be there at his execution because he said he doesn't want anybody there. And they hold hands through the grate. And even at the end of it, first of all, it's beautifully acted. It's beautifully shot. There's reflection on both sides, which Sarah and I were talking about is never easy to accomplish. Actors have
Thank
to
you,
put their heads in one spot and all that. But there is I particularly noted at the end, there's got to be a 4-second shot that's a wide shot. And it's just mm-hmm. them with their hands touching and not talking. And normally in TV, that is something that's like one of the first things to go. But it's exactly what you're saying, is that is a pure texture, tone, feeling moment that, you know, could have easily gone away. And it's really beautifully done. So that means that you actually, you know, you found the time for it. And it really worked.
It exactly goes back to my point where I said these three minutes are going to be really tough, is because those are the scenes that, of course, are identified by the people who aren't paying attention. But, you know, normally the creatives, which would be, you know, the showrunner and, you know, a lot of times the editor and the director, of course, are going, you can't cut that because it just works. And as long as you push hard enough, they'll find another place to cut to make it work. And in that case, it happened because... Again, shoot every scene like you're going to use it.
I want to ask you a couple of we wrote a couple specific things down we wanted to ask you about, but I'll just final thing on that is that what's smart about that, bringing LJ in that way so early and saying there's a real stakes here, that this kid's going to go off the rails without his father, that he's invested in it, that you see Lincoln softening a little bit. I think it really pays dividends for the stakes of saving this guy's life.
In theory, it's the reason the show matters. Why do you mm-hmm. save Lincoln? You save Lincoln because he's this man.
Because he's this man.
With his son.
That's right. And we kind of haven't seen it until that moment, really. We've just seen it.
Not much.
We haven't heard about it. So a couple of questions. Your episode introduces the character of Haywire, played by Silas Weir Mitchell. Were you involved in the Do you remember, were you involved in casting him? He ends up being, I don't know if he was a regular, but he was around for a season.
No, because again, it was, we were focused so much on, like, I remember there were so many production problems because they didn't have the set ready to shoot in, and I had to shoot all ourselves practically.
Oh my goodness.
And I remember,
so no walls moved.
Exactly. So I remember visiting the set, and Robbie's going, this isn't going to be ready by the time we're finished. And they said, sadly, we are a little delayed, so it probably isn't. And Robbie said, do you want to hold the scenes? And I said, no, I'd like to shoot it practically, because I think that in a lot of ways, being locked in that prison as the actors, I think is better for even, it just feels a bit less theatrical when you're actually in the prison, even though it's compromising maybe the lighting and the shots and, you know, and the camera angles. I was like,
you,
I was
the sense of claustrophobia.
Yeah, I mean, the scenes in when Sucre and Bellick and Michael and another guard are standing in that cell, there's no cheating. There's, you see everybody. You see shoulders. You see the back of heads. There's no clean cheat. The wall wasn't here. You really feel like you're inside the thing. You cannot.
Yeah.
For the audience that's listening, normally with something like that, you can move a wall. Therefore, there's room for the crew.
Yeah, and also when you're in prison, you are brushing shoulders with other prisoners, and you're moving through those doorways, and there's no place to breathe. And a lot of it felt like that. I mean, I have this incredible story. I constantly tell people this story. So we're at Joliet, and we're shooting a long day. I remember Robbie and I were being driven by the first AD, I think, and we jumped in the car and we're driving, and we get halfway back to Chicago and Robbie gets a phone call on his cell phone. He said, the prison's locked down. And I said, what? He said, it's locked down. It's a statewide prison lockdown. So even though Joliet was decommissioned, it was still technically part of the prison system.
Oh my God.
In Illinois. And apparently it was a statewide Illinois lockdown because there was a breach of security. So literally they locked the crew in the prison.
Shut up.
It was me, Robbie, my first AD, maybe a couple, but maybe the sound department got out of there. But even the caterers were locked.
Oh my God.
And I believe, and I won't get the story correct, but it was at least 4 hours.
Oh my goodness.
They were locked down in
there.
That's
a lot of overtime.
Yeah, and what? And yes, exactly. And like that's then Fox production went crazy. But the interesting thing was that apparently somebody told me, and this may not be true, but I was told later that an extra or somebody had wandered into a room.
Oh no!
That had us, and so it was us that triggered the alarm.
Oh
shit! And went into a room that was still under surveillance or still had the
because we didn't have the whole prison,
right? But it wasn't, there was no prisoners there, there was just
no, but there were
parts that we didn't have access to. Not only was our crew locked in Joliet prison, that we triggered a statewide lockdown,
yes, because apparently that was the policy, that if one maximum security facility was locked down, they just locked them all down until they figured out where it was.
From Fox River, from our prison, to the one that they had built across the street, there was an underground tunnel system.
Yep.
And so I remember somebody telling me that halfway through, and I was like, sorry. So just checking in as the only woman for 100 miles in any direction, it seems. That's inaccurate, but that's how it felt. I was like, there is somewhere here a trapdoor that if it opens, is discharging a real live convicted felon. They were like, that's right. I was like, cool.
That's right.
That's a great story.
Wow.
That's a really great story. Okay.
Amazing.
So I was, because then fast forwarding, I think we had to let you go to 24 where you had this giant deal. So we didn't get you back later in the first season, which would have been cool, but we didn't. We didn't get you back in the second season when the show moved to Dallas. We didn't get you back in the third season, which Paul and I weren't in. But then the show moves to LA and we get you back in season 4 at the very end, at what we thought was the very end. Turns out there was a coda a few years later. But what's it like returning to a show where, you know, I mean, you're coming in post, you know, the show hadn't aired when you directed your episode with us. You're coming back post a lot of deaths on the show. The cast has changed. There's some new faces. Fichtner was with us. You had Rappaport, I think. I don't know if he was still alive during your episodes.
Right.
Yeah. Jody Lynn O'Keefe. I mean, what's that like? Kind of returning to the scene of the crime, so to speak.
It was amazing. Again, because your cast was so fabulous. You, Sarah, everybody was so great. And they'd acknowledged my small bit of input at the very beginning and how much they appreciated that and how much water was under the bridge since then. But that, you know, it's that mutual respect, I think, that poured through, and it was great. And I think we had the same kind of conversations. We put the same energy into making it as good as we could, and everybody, and I never felt like anybody missed a beat. Everyone was still working as hard as they were the first time. I think in a lot of ways they were much more knowledgeable about who they were, so it made it a lot easier. And I was able to be like more of the pure director on that, and less laying the groundwork.
Sure.
And more just, let's just make this as good a finale as we can. Me and Kevin Weeks sort of, I think he was the producer director then, and Kevin and I
Kevin
did
Hooks,
the last
yeah.
two Kevin episodes. Hooks, yeah.
Kevin Hooks, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kevin Weeks is a goaltender.
Your Canadian Kevin is showing,
Hooks.
Brad.
Exactly. Kevin Hooks, who you know, is great because he did a couple episodes of 24 with us.
Yeah.
So Kevin graciously had me back, and it was great because, again, everybody was just as good as they were from the beginning. I remember the weirdest thing about coming back was like, just be a caught, you know, caught. It was a long time ago when you started this. These guys were all new. You know, they might be a little more of a handful. You know, the show did well. You know, I went, okay, yeah, no problem. I didn't find any of that. It was the exact opposite. I felt like I was still working with them from the third episode. It was like none of that warning, but that warning always comes from, you know, like first ADs and production managers and not people that are in the creative part of it. So you take it for what it is. And again, we're all artists. As long as we respect each other, it's always going to be great. And the most important thing I do is focus on how I can make this script and this story move and be as interesting as possible.
All right, guys, we'll be right back.
Welcome back, everybody, to Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul.
Well, I want to. I know you've got a heart out, and I want to respect your time, but I do want to say that I remember you coming back for that episode, those episodes in season 4. And part of what was such a gift about it was that you did come in to make it the best show that it could be. You came in as though it were the first show you'd ever directed. In terms of the freshness of your attitude, your respect for who we were. You know, sometimes when a show gets a little bigger, you have people who come in. I mean, I remember going 3 episodes without a note. And I was like, I know I'm not this good.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, this isn't I'm delivering an amazing performance. This is, you know, maybe somebody's not here for performance in the same way that you were. And so I just, you know, want to offer some flowers to you for showing up. You know, you didn't wave your Emmy around and say, I know what I'm doing. Everybody stand in line. You treated us like we were all in it together to make something meaningful. And that was a beautiful thing.
Well, thank you. That's what I try to do. I'm glad you identified that because that's exactly what I try to do. I have nothing but respect for writers and actors. I mean, two things I can't do. And I've got to say, you have to identify that as a director. And what you want to do is elevate everything to make it interesting to watch and not sleepy time TV.
Well, as we let you go, I want to plug the Turner Art Gallery in Bayfield, Ontario, which is an art gallery.
It doesn't exist anymore, Sarah.
Oh, no.
No, it doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, don't.
Damn, Wikipedia lied to me.
The Turner Gallery for 10 years.
About it. Oh, man.
No, that's okay.
I was all excited about it. I wanted to ask you about it, but we all have to go.
Yes.
Listen, thank you so much for being with us. Welcome. I feel like we could talk forever because I'm so curious. I've learned a lot about directing from you actually in the last 45 minutes, which is marvelous.
That's nice. Thank you.
Super, super, super grateful to you.
And yeah, ditto. And the respect you have for the thing that you do, but also the people you do it with, it shows in the work. And it's
Great.
We can all take in everything that we do in this.
Absolutely.
That's a collaboration. And then we look forward to talking to you again when we get to episode season 4, almost the end. Have you back.
Thank you so much for having me on. Thanks for doing this.
Okay, so that concludes our first guest.
Thank you, Brad Turner.
He was amazing, by the way. And we just learned today that they just announced a Prison Break spinoff.
Oh my god!
Plot twist.
You sent it to me. Big plot twist.
The
gentleman from Mayans, is that right?
The senator from Missouri. I believe the showrunner creator from Mayans is going to do a new Prison Break something on Hulu. We know nothing about it, but it's funny timing. Or is it? Dun, dun, dun. Anyway, thank you guys so much for being with us. Let's wrap this up. Our Instagram is at Prison Break Podcast. Or you can email us on our very own email site, which is prisonbreaking, one word, at caliber-studio.com. That's Caliber, C-A-L-I-B-E-R, dash studio, singular.com. And thank you for being with us. Please don't go to prison.
And if you do, establish dominance quickly.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties. Sarah Wayne Callis and Paul Edelstein. Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Keeping us slim and trim in the prison yard has been sound designer and editor Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Letting the world know what's been happening to us in prison is social media manager Emma Tolkien. Our music was done by Paul Edelstein. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliberstudio.com and call us at 401-3-P-BREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.